Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Hello and welcome to Your Book, the podcast for literary nosy parkers. I'm Daisy Buchanan, your host and the author of The Sisterhood, a love letter to the women who shaped me. If you're on the Kent coast, come and buy it from the Margate Bookshop, my lovely local. We're back after our summer holidays and we're kicking off series four with an absolute treat of an episode. We went to leafy North London to nose around the house of one of my very favourite novelists, David Nicholls. Now, I finally understand the meaning of needs no introduction, but here's one anyway. I fell in love with David's words alongside the millions of others who read his smash hit One Day. I still constantly quote bits of it, including the magnificent description of a character who is the sort of woman who'd begin a letter of condolence with the words, "Wahey," a line Victoria Wood would be jealous of. But there's David's debut, the adorable and quietly devastating Starter for Ten, the comic, tragic and hugely underrated The Understudy, the melancholy, complex grown-up Us, and the hit of the summer, Sweet Sorrow. A novel that made me feel every single emotion going, including fear. I was a teenage amateur dramatist, so the story really hit close to home. You will have watched David's words as well as read them. His screen work includes adapting Edward St. Albans' Patrick Melrose novels for TV. We talked about taking to the stage, the melancholy of the Moomins, and alternative readings of F. Scott Fitzgerald. We're in North London, and David Nicholls, really, really beautiful house. How can I put this delicately and diplomatically? So most of our guests have beautiful homes, but this is sort of the sort of house that you might go to as a child and think, wow, I'm going to be a writer when I grow up, because look at this. That's how I'm feeling right now. But there's this really, it's a very nice, it's actually, I thought it was grey, but it's a silver, a long low silver coffee table. And on here, there's a pile of LRBs. Are you dedicated reader?
They pile up. The LRBs and the New Yorkers all just kind of lie there and make you feel, making you feel bad.
Producer Dale very kindly got me an LRB subscription for my birthday, which was nearly 2 months ago, and I've not finished one yet. But there's really beautiful is that late 50s, early 60s?
I think so. Do you know, it's one of the things that I've never actually, I don't think I've even opened it. I guess
this
it is.
This might be the first time that we've looked at reproduction. Books on people's coffee tables.
It's a colouring book.
Oh, well, obviously two.
Which no one has found the time to colour, but maybe they will one
day. It's too lovely,
it is,
isn't it?
It's just for display.
I don't want your children coming
back. Actually, being creative.
There's lots of art books here and books about typography.
Yes. Well, Hannah is an art historian, so she, again, has much better taste than I do and knows about these things in a way that, I mean, it would be disastrous. It would be all clip frames and ancient film posters if it was me in charge, but it isn't.
So did you get to the...
Yes, this is the kind of, that's the sort of academia. That's where all the old books from our degree courses are kept, and all the plays and poetry.
Did you study drama and acting when you were a student, or did that come later?
No, I studied English and drama, and I was at Bristol for a long time, and we did a lot of Shakespeare and a lot of Elizabethan playwrights, so that's why there's all the Thomas Middleton and Ben Jonson and everything, and it's strange. These books are so strange, aren't they? Because I'm never going to open one of these books on Marxist Shakespeare. But I kind of like having them around. They're almost like an old photo album, I suppose, of who you used to be. So a lot of these books haven't been opened for 30 years, I'm sure.
There's lots of poetry among the plays. There's a lot of John Donne, Ezra Pound.
I really loved John Donne at university, and Shakespeare and the Elizabethans. That was my great passion. Everything else I wasn't really ready for. I sort of feel if I went there now, I might be able to offer some insight or understanding. But at the time, it really, a lot of it went over my head. I was really bluffing my way through. And all I really wanted to do at university was do plays, you know, be in plays. And that was my great passion.
Were you in a lot of Shakespeare?
I was. I was in A Midsummer Night's Dream when I was in my first year of university. So I was Puck. I gave my Puck. I was Lysander. I think I've played nearly every part in Midsummer Night's Dream. Starveling, all of these parts.
To go in as Puck, that's quite a... That is a key role.
It wasn't a great performance. It was quite big, I think. I think that was the distinctive quality of all my theatrical performances, was a kind of scale, was a great enthusiasm and no real skill. But I did love it, and I didn't do enough, really. I was in Much Ado About Nothing, which is my favourite Shakespeare play, but playing Dogberry. And again, it was just a lot of goofing around and a lot of unfortunate, unfunny stage business. And I never really did anything particularly well. But I did love it. And
it's funny because I was thinking about just that the other day. I loved drama at school and I was never any good at all. But the notes from our teachers were always, you know, dial it down, wind it in, you are too much.
Yes.
And I remember I got a very, very, very bad mark for my Miss Gibson in Daisy Pulls It Off. I think it was Miss Gibson, the headmistress.
Right.
And I'd been sort of going a bit wacky with it and being encouraged, and then I just really went to town when it was being marked. And I think I failed, or I got a D or an E or something, because they were like, no, that was just you took it too far.
Yes, I think do less was the note I got throughout my acting career. Even when I didn't have any lines, do less was the note that used to come back. In fact, this is my, hold on a second, I'm just climbing up here.
David is climbing on his teeth.
This is a history of the National Theatre, and if I find the page, here we are.
Hearing a bit of page turning.
There it is. You see this silhouette there? This is a production of Machinal with Fiona Shaw. There, that's me.
Oh wow!
So, and I had four lines, I think, and two of the words were case demurred, but I couldn't work out how to say demurred in a American accent. So I think it was case demurred. So I don't think anyone even understood what I was saying. But yeah, that black shape at the back is me. And even there in the picture, you can tell I'm doing a little too much.
The tilt of the head. Is that why you have that book?
It's not the only reason. But it is pretty much the only proof I have that I actually did any of these productions.
If it were me, that would be why I'd have the book. There's no shame in it. Who would you have most liked to have played who you didn't have the opportunity to play?
Well, a terrible thing is I sort of did play the part. The parts I always thought I could do were the kind of the students and the earnest students in Chekhov plays like Andrei and Three Sisters or Constantine in The Seagull. And I was in The Seagull at the National Theatre understudying Constantine. Which is
The Seagull in the understudy?
No, it's not. In the understudy, it's a kind of made-up play.
Ah.
But I was an understudy for a long time. And I did understudy these great parts that I'd have loved to have played. Best part being Constantine and The Seagull, which was one of my favourite plays and a great part. And when you're an understudy, you get to do a run on the main stage in front of an invited audience. So I have actually played that part, but to an empty theatre. I mean, about six people in the theatre. So I learnt a lot of great roles and rehearsed them and never performed them
almost
in front
like
of anyone.
Almost like action karaoke.
Yeah, very strange. And after a while, quite dispiriting. I mean, when you start, you sort of think, well, I'm learning technique and I'm getting to work with these really good actors. And if you're in an understudy company, there's a sense of camaraderie and you're all in this thing together. But you're waiting, really, for someone to fall ill. And it never happened. for a lot of my fellow understudies, it did. They did go on and play big parts. But no, I never quite got to do it.
It's all about Eve, isn't it? You think that is going to be your chance, that it's an element of fatalism, I guess. The universe will give you that.
Yes. And and consequently, you have this rather uneasy relationship with the person you're understudying because you've been employed, because you were a little bit like them.
Mm.
You know, you share certain performance traits and you look the same and you can fit in the same costumes. But even when you get on, even when you become friends, you're always wanting something terrible to happen to them. Not truly terrible, but terrible enough for them to miss a matinee.
Awful, awful thing where you probably, I'm sure if it were me, I wouldn't be able to help but compare and just be like, what is it that you have that I don't have that means you're...
And often, I think...
The full-time version.
The misapprehension I went into theatre with really was that it was a kind of, that it would be like university theatre, you know, that you'd audition. And there'd be a kind of a sort of socialistic sense of the company and everyone working together. And of course, it's very class-ridden and status-obsessed, the theatre. And you have to have a certain kind of agent and you have to have certain ways in and know certain people. And I didn't have any of that, really. So
I suppose as well, means to be employed elsewhere, either precariously or not at all, so you can go often.
Yeah, absolutely. So that you can keep it going. I mean, most of the time I was I had an equity card for about 8 years and I was probably employed for about maybe 2.5 if I added them all together, all the periods of employment. And the rest of the time I was working in bars, working in bookshops, or not working, just waiting. And it was very stressful. It was very worrying. I mean, I was a nervous wreck through all my 20s, really, with that kind of anxiety. Was it going to happen? Oh, would I get another job? Would the next job be better than the last one? And there was no upward movement, really. So,
did you find any solace in the bookshops, or was it just very hard?
No, I loved working. I spent a long time working in Waterstones, and I really loved it there. I loved working in the bookshops, and I left it to go to the National Theatre and understudy for a long time. And I did miss it. I loved the staff and I loved talking about books. I loved talking to the customers and it was really a very happy place to work.
Were you an effective bookseller? Can you remember what you'd recommend to people if they asked?
I was, yeah. I was very diligent and enthusiastic and I read a lot of new releases and I was really quite passionate about it. I used to run the children's section.
Oh.
And I was very proud of my children's section to the point where I'd almost get a little annoyed if any children went in there. And touch the books because, you know, I'd alphabeticize the picture books and make sure it was well stocked and everything. And I loved it there. I really loved the people. But then, you know, this offer came through to be in Arcadia, the Tom Stoppard play at the National Theatre, to understudy. And so I took that instead.
So have you always written something?
No, not at all. No, I always thought that there was something quite, not arrogant, but presumptuous, I suppose, about writing and asking someone to read your work. The only thing I wrote consistently were letters. I was always writing to my friends and putting quite a lot of care into the letters and making sure they had jokes and stories in and observations. And the good friends who received these letters used to tell me that there might be something in that, that, you know, that writing was certainly a better bet than acting. And I had a couple of friends really who sort of forced me to write things. My friend Matthew, who was a theatre director, wanted to write a film and asked me to work with him. And another friend of mine, Claudia, who is a TV producer, I used to tell stories about the times I'd spent working in restaurants and bars and the people I met there. And she was sure that this would make a good comedy, this would make a good sitcom. So she, again, just pressurised me, kept on going on at me to write a script about my time spent working in restaurants. And I did both of those projects with not a great deal of confidence, you know, rather shyly. They were good, you know, they both worked out. They were well received. And I think I got paid, you know, a £50 fee from the BBC for the option on the sitcom, which was called Waiting. And the film that I co-wrote with Matthew, there was a lot of interest in that. It was based on a Sam Shepard play, and eventually it got made. So I was sort of pressured into doing it. I don't have great piles of manuscripts. I wouldn't have been confident enough, I think, to ask people to read them. So I had to be forced, really.
Did you enjoy it once you were doing it, or was a bit of you sort of thinking, still, why?
I never felt that anything would happen with it. Again, I felt, you know, very far removed from that world, and I didn't really know what I was doing. I mean, when I started writing that first film script, I didn't know how it should look on the page. It was an adaptation of this play, but I didn't know how that worked, how you would open up a play and turn it into a film. I sort of learnt as I went along, really.
I suppose it's quite a kind of an intense, insular thing to do after doing a creative job that depends so much on the creative work of other people and having all those cues of sort of how to respond and where you are to suddenly be like, oh, it's just me and this page.
You mean to go to fiction or
to go any kind of writing, I think, from the theatre?
Yes. No, I think there was always a question about who would actually, you know, be interested in these things.
Because I love that in Sweet Sorrow, not to do a spoiler, but towards the very end, there's, I think, a kind of a friendly intervention.
Yes.
And I thought of that when you were talking about what your friends were doing and saying, no, these are what your talents are, you must go and use them.
Yes, I mean, the understudy is dedicated to my friends Matthew and Roanna, who were the ones who really said, stop, find something else. And actually, I realised, you know, that what I loved about acting was writing, and that if there was a way of doing that, either as a script editor or a writer myself, then that would be a much, much better option.
I think we should go and look at some more.
And so the fiction kind of starts up there. It's very vaguely alphabetical. The alphabetical order kind of breaks down halfway through the second shelf, but to begin with, it's pretty good.
I think it's pretty. I can only crane my neck so far. I see Amos, I see Bruckner, I see Bronte. Yeah, you've got the A's and B's and C's together. And Joseph Conrad, Wilkie Collins. What do you do if you want a book from the top shelf? Do you have a ladder?
There is a ladder, yeah. I don't think I've reached up there for a while. I think... again, a lot of it is a kind of diary, isn't it, of your reading life. They're books that you haven't necessarily opened for a long time, but and they often belong in a very particular, very specific time of your life. And I couldn't bear the idea of not having them, but I don't ever expect to open many of them again, really.
Their Sorbello paperbacks look fabulous. They're sort of 60s, 70s?
Yeah.
I don't know when they're
those 80s. Are Hannah's. She's much more of the Bello enthusiast than I am. I've tried many times and I find him quite hard. We both love a lot of American fiction, so Saul Bellow is her big passion.
Can you remember the first books that you gave each other, or the first books you read together or found out that you both loved?
Yes, it was. The first book Hannah gave me is down here, actually. Ooh. And what is it? It's, I think it's the actual edition. It's Tobias Wolff. It was a book of short stories by Tobias Wolff. I think, is this the one? And this was sort of on my, this was on my 31st birthday. I can't find the actual volume. Oh, there it is. I think it's this one.
Short stories. That's a really short good, I think, a gift to get, because you think, well, there'll be one in there they like. Or, you know, it's not quite as pressurised as giving someone a novel.
No, absolutely. I'm making it sound like it's this great precious item and now I can't find it, but it's in there somewhere. But yes, Tobias Wolff was the first one, and I think I then gave her some Salinger, which of course she'd read, and that wasn't such a good choice. But Hannah studied American literature and I've always loved American writing, so that was something we had in common.
So we skipped over.
I know, that's funny. We'd slam to the other
end. Are these
a
bit less kind of alphabetized and organized? Although
it
see,
all goes wrong, you see. It all goes.
Tobias Wolff is right by Virginia Woolf.
And then after that, it all goes to hell, really. And these are more recent books. I mean, here are the multiple copies of Edward St. Aubyn, because they were all sort of scribbled in and hacked about and cut into pieces when I was working on the script. So there are, you know, 15 copies of them all around the house.
Do do you say if you're just really bored of talking about this and don't really want to talk about it anymore? But were you approached to write that adaptation, or did you think, I love these books and I want to make them into something?
I the latter, really. I had to kind of pitch for it, really. I'd read, we were talking earlier about working in a bookshop, and I'd read Nevermind, the first one, while I was working in Waterstones, and then I read them as they came out every 5 years or so, and I loved them. And I was sure that there was a way to do them. So when the rights were finally acquired by a producer for all five, I went and had this meeting. And One Day was the most recent thing. One Day had just come out. And there was really no overlap in terms of
style
or subject matter. So I realised that it was quite a hard gig to win. But I met the producers and we had a good chat. And I said what I thought we might draw out in the books. And then I went for lunch with Edward St. Auburn and did the same kind of thing and asked a few questions and suggested things I might change and what I wanted to keep hold of. And then I got the job. And
was he very enthusiastic about seeing it on screen, or did he have reservations about...
He was a little anxious, I think, because, you know, the books are so autobiographical and are very hard to adapt, because they're so... Not only is the subject matter so tough, it's that they're very internal books. They're not books that are based on... Usually when you're working on an adaptation, you're looking for narrative. Scripts are very good on...
I've not really thought about that, but there aren't very many kind of anchoring points where you can sort of visually have, well, this happens here and this happens here. Yeah. You've got to kind of create those, I guess.
There's nothing you could call a plot, really. Mm. And there's no reason why a book should have, or a series of books should have, the structure of a drama, but you need to impose that on it without twisting it, without being too unfaithful, without committing too much violence on the original material. So it took a long time. I mean, it took 5 years of writing and rewriting to get all of them in a producible state. But he was pretty supportive. After our first meeting, he said, you know, we can either talk all the time or we can not talk at all. And you can either, you know, use me as a resource or just use the books. And I, in the end, ended up really just referring to the books.
If I were to say, David, I have £100 million in my bag and I have acquired all rights to everything forever in perpetuity, you can adapt anything you like, cast whoever you want, you've got carte blanche.
Oh, it's a tricky one. I mean, for years and years, I really wanted to do Danny the Champion of the World by Roald Dahl. And I have just done that. I mean, I've just written a first script, so a first draft. It's a long way off. I don't know if it'll ever happen.
Are we allowed to know about this?
Well, I hope by the time this goes out, I hope so. I mean, it's a long way off, you know, it's just a first draft and who knows what'll happen, and it's very early days. But that was always my dream, that and Edward St. Auburn. And I suppose the other thing I feel about it is that the desire to adapt things is sometimes something that you have to fight a little bit. You know, not everything works on screen. And there are certain things in the book that are very, very hard to do on screen. Internal voices, first-person narratives, novels that take place over a long period of time. So there are a lot of novels that I really, really love, which I would turn down just because I wouldn't know how to do them. A novel like The Good Soldier by Ford Madox Ford, which is a novel I think is wonderful. It's very hard to adapt something that has an unreliable narrator because... on screen, when you show something, it has an objective truth. This is what happened. In a novel, two or three or four things can be true at the same time. And the whole point of The Good Soldier is you don't know who this character is and how truthful they are and how much you can rely on them. So that's a book that I'd love to do, but I'm not sure that you can do it. Another one is Hangover Square by Patrick Hamilton, which I have tried to do. I've tried to get going before because I think it's a wonderful book. But the right situation is, again, too complicated. But even that, I think it's very hard to get this. I don't know if you do know the book.
I don't know Hangover Square.
Hangover Square is fantastic. But it's about a character who... It's a very old-fashioned notion of schizophrenia, the idea that this character has a kind of Jekyll and Hyde personality. And in the novel, you know which version he is because the author can tell you. On screen, you don't have a an authorial voice to tell you what's going on. And so you're seeing what the other characters are seeing, and the story doesn't work quite as well. So there are books that I'd love to do without knowing how to do them. But a book that is available, which I'd love to do, I can't think of. I love Muriel Spark, and Girls of Slender Means by Muriel Spark is a fantastic book. I feel a, you know, better book than Miss Jean Brodie. And
I agree.
That's one I think about a lot and wonder whether it's possible to do it. Like a lot of Muriel Spark stories, it has these strange, surprising elements, like the terrible violence at the end, you know, the murder that comes out of nowhere that doesn't really have any kind of... there's no lead up. It's just a kind of random act of violence. Things like that are very, very tricky. So she's tricky. I really love Muriel Spark, but that and The Driver's Seat, which is another book that I think is extraordinary.
It must be really, really difficult to read for pleasure when a bit of you is thinking... Could this work?
Yes, yes. Is this another rights available? And yeah, no, almost everything I read now, there's a voice in the back of my head thinking, how would you do this? So I'm trying to shake that off. And if I write another script anytime soon, I'd hope that it would be an original screenplay.
When do you read?
Well, I used to read at night, but now, of course, it's like it just knocks me unconscious. And I'm a terrible insomniac, so much so that I had to go to the series of workshops to overcome this chronic insomnia. And the cardinal rule was not to read in bed, was to keep the two things separate. So now I get up early in the mornings because that also tends to help my insomnia. And I read sort of 6 till 7 if I can. But it's harder now. I know this is a common refrain, but I do find the concentration thing much harder, and I have to have my computers and phone in a different room and the internet blocker on and all of these things. The days of sitting around and reading for 3 or 4 hours I think are probably gone, sadly.
It's a bit of a shock, isn't it, when you realise that concentration is a muscle and you don't just have it and certain things limit it and fry it.
Yes, no, absolutely. And I'm sure there are books that I read quite happily in my 20s that I couldn't read now. When I was in my 20s, I was ill quite often for various reasons. I spent a lot of time kind of sitting around in bed, so it's either worrying or reading. And I read through most of Dickens, just one after another, quite methodically, because I had all this spare time to read and worry in. And I don't think I could do that now, not just because of the practicalities of life and family, but because I don't think I have the dedication and the concentration anymore, which is sad. I hope I get it back. I'd hate to think... I never used to feel intimidated by 1,000-page novels in a way that I do now.
I suppose Dickens is quite a good friend to the anxious, that you meet a lot of people in those books who are worrying about something.
Yes.
And I think that if you're at a point in your life when you've got a lot of things that you're worried about, it's quite... you feel as though you're in good company.
Well, Dickens was the first, I suppose, serious novelist, a novelist that I thought of as a classic novelist that I really, really loved. Great Expectations and David Copperfield, I found myself just identifying with in a way that I hadn't found before, really, with fiction. And I still really love him, even though I haven't read one all the way through for maybe 8 years or so. I worked on a film of Great Expectations, so I read it over and over and over again. The unfortunate result of that is that you slightly go off the book you're reading just through familiarity. It's like hearing the same voice over and over and over again. And I still hold on to it, though, as the book that had the biggest effect on me in the book. I still my favourite book,
when
I think.
When did you read it first?
I think I must have been about 15 or 16. I'd read a kind of children's cut-down version of Oliver Twist, which I'd loved, but then Great Expectations really did have a very profound effect on me. I still find it very, very moving. I think often when people think of Dickens and this idea of the Dickensian, it's about a kind of satire and a larger-than-life characters and this kind of scale, this slightly caricatured...
It's a woman with big tits making a pie while a man in a hat twirls in the star. Oh, I assume this is very well cool.
It's the sort of lots of sort of very humble characters who have a single characteristic, which is
Which is their name.
Yeah, which is their name. And that's actually the thing that I like least about him. I've always thought that there's a much, if you dig into the best of the books, there's a much more interesting, much darker psychology in Great Expectations or Bleak House or Our Mutual Friend. To me, is the great strength of Dickens, is that darker stuff, the stuff that's more grounded and richer and less one or two dimensional.
Something I think about a lot is the number of very, you know, I suppose, classic books, I'm doing air quotes, for the podcast listeners, you know, things that are very highly regarded, but now, not necessarily stylistically, but in terms of themes, they could be sold as YA books. And I think Great Expectations absolutely is, because I think it's all about, you know, youth and hope and people thinking a lot about becoming the people that they want to be. Yes. I suppose that's all books.
But, well, no, I mean, I think Great Expectations is when I'm writing something, certain books, not literally, but they're in front of me. They're the books that are in my mind. And Great Expectations certainly sneaks into my first book, Start of a Ten, quite a lot. And there's a little bit of it in the most recent book. That idea of trying to work out who you are and who you want to be, and the business, that the sometimes quite difficult emotional business of moving away from where you come from and your family, that's a recurring theme.
Now I think about it, not to tell you what your own book's about, but thinking about Sweet Sorrow and that party scene, and that I think is one of the best party scenes I've ever read. It's just so enchanting and thrilling, because it's everything you want in your dream when a party really, really goes right. Yeah. And I think there is that, you know, idea of sort of people taking you at your own hopeful and generous estimation.
Yes.
And I think there's something a bit sort of pippish
there. Yes, no, absolutely. And the way he's swept away by this world, which initially he feels excluded from, and then he's sort of actually welcomed into it, or seems to be initially at least.
That very, very brief sweet spot for anyone where you think, this isn't for me. And then you think, oh, no, actually, I'm not for this. Bit where it's all meshing.
Yes.
So brief, but so beautiful.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
We'll be back to David soon, but now it's time for my Steal of the Week, the story you'd check the bookcase for first if your house got broken into. This week it's Evening in Paradise, a collection of short stories by Lucia Berlin, which is being reissued by Picador. Many of our guests love Berlin's famous collection, A Manual for Cleaning Women, and that's been on my to-read pile for a while. But this leaped into my line of vision immediately, and I'm so glad it did. Berlin lived a sad, strange and thrilling life, and it seeps into her stories in vivid detail. There are tales of Chilean high society, of loving and leaving drug addicts, intense friendships, surviving in the city and thriving in the wilderness. She's a little bit Sedaris, a little bit Lorca, but her voice is entirely her own, and I can't recommend this hard enough. It really will stay with you forever. That's Evening in Paradise by Lucia Berlin, published by Picador. Huge thanks to Camilla Elworthy at Picador for my copy. Now, back to David. Shall we?
Yes, we go back to the middle.
So we've
leapt from A to Z.
I see. Oh! What is these. Oh, I meant to ask you about one over there that I saw and I thought I recognised, but I can't see the spine. Is that the Nell's Ink?
It is, yes.
I really love those books.
I've only read the first of the two. I mean, it's very...
Did you read The Wall Creeper?
I read The Wall Creeper, yeah. I mean, and it was fascinating because it does very... It's interesting. Sometimes you want to read writers who you aspire to and who you would like to emulate and learn from. And at other times you read writers that you think, well, I have nothing in common with this writer. I couldn't do this. This isn't my voice or experience or anything. And yet there's a kind of pleasure in that. And I found that with her and with a lot of, I suppose, more avant-garde or modernist writers. I'm intrigued and at the same time think page after page, I couldn't do this. I couldn't do anything remotely like this.
I was thinking, perhaps because Miss Lade is more, but I think her voice, and I wasn't expecting it necessarily when something is sort of so very, very hyped. And you're like, oh, I hope I like this. And I don't know if I'm going to like this. Yeah. And then it kind of, I felt consumed and absorbed and I didn't want to look up straight away. But she does feel like a lot like the American writers I love. And I don't know if it's to do with kind of economy or confidence or what it is, especially because, you know, The Wall Creeper is in Germany mostly. Or, maybe it's extra American when it's about that sort of foreignness and strangeness. But because I know you said about being very fond of American literature and whether she reminded you of anyone or anything, or she,
well, I think what I what I really like in a lot of I'm just trying to pin down why I love, well, when I was younger in particular I loved writers like John Irving, I suppose, was the first one, and Ken Kesey, is it Kesey or Kesey?
I don't know.
I
Ken
liked very much wrote One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. I loved those books, and I suppose I could tell that they were drawing from a kind of European tradition. I mean, John Irving is clearly taking a lot from Dickens.
Mm.
But there's a kind of exoticism to American domestic life, to domestic life in American fiction, that a lot of great 20th century American writing makes ordinary lives feel very rich and deep and complicated.
There's something, perhaps it's that sort of post-war thing, but I'm not confident about this, but I'm going to have a stab. a very basic level of affluence that seems to be in America, whereas here it's still a little bit kind of pinched and restrained and sort of, you know, even if you can have the shiny thing that makes it all easy, it's a bit vulgar, whereas there's none of that. And there's sort of the sense of people being very, you know, they can focus absolutely on their interior lives because, you know, everything's gleaming and fabulous in there.
Yes, I mean, that reminds me of John Cheever, who I really, really love, and read a lot of while I was writing the book before this one, Us, because there's that sense of, as you say, comfortable lives, middle-class lives, lives that seem quite respectable and stable on the surface, but are full of unspoken terror, really, and fear and anxiety and unhappiness. And that's a recurring idea in a lot of 20th century American writing. And I don't know why I'm attracted to that. I think maybe domestic writing, you're writing about family and relationships in America, is maybe given a little more, I don't know why the fact of its Americanness gives it more respect, critical respect or weight, but it's that seems to be the case. Maybe there's less snobbery about writing about family or domestic life in America.
I suppose perhaps as well because a place where history is so recent, so much more is made of the history.
Yeah.
They can't be casual about it.
Yes. I certainly went through, there was definitely a time where it's pretty much all I read. Roth and Updike Bellow was the one that always defeated me. Scott Fitzgerald, who again was someone I really, really loved during that time when I was fixated on American writing.
Hemingway.
But the Hemingways are
stunning.
Much are nicer editions. Yeah.
Early editions.
They're all Hannahs, I'm afraid. But I've got a lot
you're
of very scrappy Scott Fitzgerald up on the top shelf. But
They're very handsome too. They're called,
I mean, that was a writer I really, really fell in love with.
What's your favourite?
Well, Tender as the Night is the one I completely
Me
love.
Too. I read it every year.
Yeah. And I think it's a very... I think often maybe it's the second most famous book that's actually the best book. Like, we were talking about Girls of Slender Means. I think Tender as the Night is a much better book than The Great Gatsby. I mean, I can see that The Great Gatsby is more concentrated and more perfect, but Tender as the Night is the one that I go back to a lot.
My understanding is that there was an early version of Tender as the Night that was like completely chronological.
Oh, no, yes, that was posthumously, I think. Yeah, and because Tender as the Night sold, 2,000 copies or something. It did very, very badly. And then he died, and I think the publisher tried rejigging it so that it was told chronologically. And I've read both versions.
I'm sure I have, but I'm not sure. Yeah, looking at the ones that I have, I don't know where I would have got this secret chronological version.
The one I think is disastrous. I mean, I think it's clearly the wrong way around. It's much, much better when you see this perfect life and then find out the truth behind it, rather than there being no surprise.
I think it's interesting how icy and tricky and difficult Nicole is, when you know that she's endured this tragedy. Yeah. You don't kind of make that leap, and I don't know if that's to do with sort of extreme wealth or what it is. And I think about Dick a lot.
Yes.
And how powerful he is, and then how weak and unraveled, and and it's got the flattest ending ever.
Yeah,
but it couldn't end any other way. It's like, oh, that was a shame.
Though interestingly, I read it recently, and when I read it when I was 17, 18. I loved Dick Diver so much. I thought he was fantastically touching and tragic, and this great man with all this wonderful potential just fades into the crowd. But when I read it recently, I felt a lot less sympathetic towards him. I mean, so much so that I worried that I thought maybe I should just put the book down and walk away, because he suddenly seemed quite predatory and creepy and self-pitying. No, he doesn't. No, and his pursuit of Rosemary, the actress, actually now seems a little bit squalid. Mm. And I'm almost scared to read it again in case I kind of turn on it. But I still love its melancholy. There's a wonderful character in it called Abe North, who's the talented musician who drinks himself to death and dies off stage, so to speak.
Is he the one who's always sort of looking out for Nicole a little bit?
He's in love with Nicole, and he throws away his talent and...
Oh, he's Ian! Abe North is Ian.
Well, Ian in One Day. Yeah, except Ian is, not particularly talented, but yes, he's the sort of... He's the loyal watcher, I suppose. But I always thought Abe was the character was incredibly touching. And I found the whole book very moving, except, as I say, for this last reading where I thought, oh my goodness, I'm not sure if I should look at this again. But I feel that with a lot of books. I feel that if I love Thomas Hardy, and yet if I'd never read a Thomas Hardy and I picked up Tess now, I'm not sure that I'd love it as much as I do because of the time when I read it. Oh, yes, Girl in Winter.
Is that you? That's a beautiful edition, may I? This is lovely. I don't know if it's an old library copy. £3, which seems very reasonable. Although it was originally
£1.20 in 1950-something. I love Larkin's poetry, and I read A Girl in Winter when I was sort of 17, 18. I realise a lot of my tastes and favourite books and favourite writers come from that particular period, and I loved Larkin. And again, I tried to read A Girl in Winter not so long ago, and because I was thinking, when I was thinking about Start of a Ten, it's because it's a university novel, and couldn't quite work out why I'd loved it so much when I'd first read it. Maybe I'm confusing it with Jill. Oh no, it's A Girl in Winter. Yes, Jill is the one set in university, and Girl in Winter is the family one. But I don't know, there's so many books here that I think, I mean, there's a big D.H. Lawrence section there, and I've never read a D.H. Lawrence novel, I'm ashamed to say. The list of things that I have to read is huge. The gaps in my knowledge are really terrible. Let's budge them up. Oh, I don't know if there's any more.
Do you feel that hypothetically you will read these at some point?
No,
I just
started.
Do you think this is represent hope? Or...
I suppose, yes. It's not just the books I've read, it's the books I hope to read. But I feel now, I mean, I've started to do that terrible sum about how many more books I might squeeze into the next 20 years. And it's not many. It's not enough. So there are things that I will definitely get to. But I could draw up a list of the next 20 books that I'd love to go one after another. But I know things will get in the way.
Do you ever give up on a book? Are you a completist?
I do, more so now.
And do you ever think one day I'll come back, or do you just think, no, this is not
something I'm
enjoying?
Again, I used to think that, but now I've accepted that if it's not working, then it'll never get picked up again.
Are these Kundera's yours?
Yes. I mean, like you were saying, when you associate certain spines with certain times of your life, those Faber editions and the white spine picadors as well, there was that great passion, wasn't there, for books in translation, picador, Latin American writing and East European writing.
I don't think this is the unsettling cover, but I definitely read that edition of The Book of Laughter and Forgetting.
Yeah.
But he's a writer that I read him when I was a teenager, and I don't think I'm smart enough now. I think I've killed too many brain cells. Have you read them all? You were
I've read Unbearable Lightness of Being and Life is Elsewhere, but I could tell you almost nothing about them. It must have been 1987 or something. I think that was the high point of Milan Kundera reading.
Have you read that Alan Hollinghurst?
I've read all of them except that one.
Because I saw a load somewhere.
Yes, there's some.
Saw Line of Beauty.
I loved The Line of Beauty. I really did. I thought that was a fantastic book, and it reminded me a lot of someone else I've just seen up there, Ian Forster, who I also really loved. That again was Howard's End. I read when I was 18 or 19 and found it just wonderful. And I'd never really read a book from that era. Most of what I'd read that I thought of as classics were Victorian, and I absolutely loved Howard's End.
And it's funny, isn't it, when you assume something might be a little bit sort of pompous or miserable, somehow earnest and worthy, and then there's a lot of life in something, people you recognise.
Yes, there's a character in it called Leonard Bast, who I found myself identifying with hugely, this idea of aspiration. There's a terrible line about him, about his great familiarity with the outside of books. And at 17, 18, I was self-aware enough, to realise that a lot of the love I had for books and a lot of the talk I had about it, a lot of the lines I had about fiction were, a lot of my understanding was quite superficial, and that it wasn't disconnected from the idea. Reading was one thing, being seen to be a reader was another element on top of that, I think. This is a writer I really love, Helen Garner, who's an Australian novelist. Only three novels, I think, and a lot of really fantastic journalism and memoir. But those three novels are really wonderful. The Spare Room is a really brilliant, pin-sharp, dark comedy about the limits of friendship. And the earlier book, The Children's Bark, I think is absolutely stunning. It was out of print in this country for a long time. But it's a very touching story about a loving family. Again, a domestic novel about a loving family that falls to pieces, that an interloper arrives and shakes things up and things start to go wrong. But I really, really love her writing. She reminds me a lot of another writer I love, Elizabeth Strout, who I really, really admire. And this very incisive, tough, but touching analysis of family life, I think, is something I really, really admire. But Helen Garner, I think, should be better known. I think she's really a wonderful writer.
I've just seen this Penelope Lively being... So I love these, the Penguin Modern Classics with the Ada Neale covers.
Yeah.
Have you been reading this?
I have. I wanted to read... I mean, the last book, Sweet Sorrow, is set over the course of a summer, and so I was reading a lot of literature which has a summer setting. This is Heatwave by Penelope Lively, which again is a kind of chamber piece that unfolds over the course of one summer, so a similar structure to Sweet Sorrow. I think when you're writing, you want to read things that you can draw on without feeling as if you're ripping them off, or that they're going to sway you in a, or push you in a direction you don't want to take. And I knew that wasn't going to happen with this book, but I loved the atmosphere of this rural summer setting. And you mentioned Penelope Fitzgerald. That's another writer who I...
Who's called Penelope,
but who I'm also really obsessed with. I spent a lot of the last couple of years trying to turn one of her novels into a play, and I couldn't quite pull it off. But I loved going back to that book again and again. That's a, one of her earlier novels called At Freddy's, which I think is a hugely underrated comic novel. Very, very funny novel, and best novel about theatre that I can think of. Again, it was one of those books that I had in mind that I could kind of... that it was good to have it close while I was writing about theatre, because it was a... it's very hard to write about that world without being precious or sentimental or pretentious. And Penelope Fitzgerald has just the right amount of cynicism. You know, she takes it seriously, but it's also extremely funny about that world and those people.
I've just seen you've got one of my problematic faves. I'm going to pronounce it very badly, so I'm just going to say Dangerous Liaisons. I think I had to read it as a student, and I thought, oh, bloody hell, what is this? But it's, but obviously that's been done.
Yes.
Very sort of baroquely. Yes. Was there a play as well?
Yes, it was a play originally, then a film, and then various modern versions. But written in letter form again, which again you would think would make it very, very hard to adapt. There's all these... this is not my proper study. This is the home study, but it's all film books and graphic novels and things like that.
Oh, wow.
And foreign editions.
Yeah. Is that a Russian? No, it can't be Russian. That starts
which one?
I'm looking at the start of a tense. Kaiki Pelin?
Oh, goodness, I should know. Oh, yes, I think that's Polish, maybe. That's my guess.
Where are you? Where are your fans other than here in the US? Do you have any... are you big in any unexpected places?
Germany is... Germany, there's a lot of British... authors in translation in Germany, and Germany is a great place to do book events. I mean, they're these epic events. They're sort of 2 hours long.
Wow.
And often you'll read in English and then an actor will perform in German and
wow.
then you'll read in English again, and the audiences are incredibly attentive and the events are really long. And
how do you feel? Is there any part of you looking at the actor thinking, that should be me? Or are you quite relieved?
No. They always read. I tend to get a little bit, I do too much when I read. I've done these tours where you travel around with your actor. And so I love doing events in Germany, even though I come back as if I've just done some kind of great world stadium tour. I'm completely exhausted. The conversations is fantastic. Yeah, that's a series of discussions between Walter Murch, the great film editor, and the book next to it, Conversations with Wilder, by Cameron Crowe, is absolutely fantastic. That's really wonderful. That's a series of very informal but very incisive and intriguing conversations with Billy Wilder, who's one of my heroes, really. Mm. That's a fantastic book, incredibly entertaining, but full of wisdom about screenwriting. The only book that's better, I think, about film is up there. Truffaut's book with Hitchcock, which is absolutely
incredible.
Great. And
I've heard that so many times.
I mean, a great kind of guide, really, to filmmaking, film editing, and faded
I love how,
and scruffy, but I love it.
Unflattering, that picture of Alfred Hitchcock. We are in David's bedroom. The few writers who've kindly...
There are loads and loads of books in here.
But
there are so many books here that... and the books that I'm currently reading.
The Idiot by Elif Bauman. I love that book.
That was great.
It's
really, fantastic.
Really funny. Oh, I wanted to ask about the Tove Jansson as well, because I saw some of her downstairs.
Well, I haven't read the grown-up books, but the Moomins had a huge effect on me. I found them so sad and strange. I think I must have been seven or eight or something, and I read all of them straight through. And those later Moomin books, I still think there's a kind of, when I think about them, I can summon up the memory of the melancholy that those books provoked, which is very strange, isn't it? It's a very strange response to have to a book when you're a child. To feel deeply sad.
Andy Miller talks about this a lot. And yeah. I think he's so right about there were so few things for him in childhood that said that a lot of this is sort of long and miserable and difficult and complicated and relentless feeling. And the Moomins did that when everything else is a bit, you know, yeah, jollying you along. It's like best days of your lives.
Yeah. No, I did. I think even at that stage, I loved it as well. I mean, melancholy is a kind of a strange sensation to feel drawn to when you're a child. It makes me sound very kind of moody and dark. I don't think I was. But I did love the sadness that was in those books.
Oh, Laurie Moore, I just read, because Sinead Gleeson talked about Who Will Save the Frog...
Frog Hospital.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, I absolutely love that book. It's so one of my favourite novels.
Laurie Moore before, and yeah. It took me a little while, I think, because even though it's not an enormous book, something happens in that book that is not dissimilar from Sweet Sorrow. Mm-hmm. There's someone is doing their summer job and is running a scam. Yeah. Thinking, it's not going to end well, is it?
No. I thought that book was... I mean, I love Laurie Moore. I love her short stories. And I think that novel as well is really underrated. And it's really, really a really brilliant snapshot of a particular period in your adolescence, and again was the book that I kind of thought of a lot when I was writing Sweet Sorrow. I really loved it. There's certain writers, you know, who kind of you read and you immediately want to run to your keyboard and write in the hope that you'll take some of that with you, that you'll somehow, by reading them, you've sort of absorbed those insights and that style, that beautiful writing. And
are there any writers that you unconsciously find yourself imitating? And you sort of write a sentence or two or a page and think, oh, no, that's...
It's interesting. Writers that I have to avoid, who I really admire, but I have to avoid because I know that I'll end up doing a bad version, particularly in comedy, writers like David Sedaris, you know, it's a very distinctive, really brilliant, finely tuned comic voice. And it would be, you know, all too easy to write a kind of pastiche, to write a bad version of that kind of comic tone. So I have to make sure I don't do this bad impersonation, even though you admire them and you kind of aspire to that kind of writing. Laurie Moore's another one. Sue Townsend was another one, you know, really fantastic comic writer and very precise and clever in the way she uses everyday objects and trade brand names and things like that, and you have to put a line through it if you're obviously copying it too clearly.
But then I think that's such a great lesson, isn't there? So much humour in what is very, very specific.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think a lot of the writers like Sue Townsend or Victoria Wood or Alan Bennett does it a little as well, those very, very specific cultural references that are very funny, but it can sometimes be, if not used well, it can be a bit of an easy joke.
I love Feel Free, and I love Zadie Smith as a novelist, and I love her as an essayist even more, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. A writer who I will read anything and everything by Zadie Smith, and the fiction is fantastic, I think. I love these books too. I mean, they're sort of, it's a bit of a vice, isn't it, reading about how other writers write. But these volumes of Paris Review interviews, I think they're incredibly entertaining.
They're
great. They're really great. There's four of them. And
was it Patricia Lockwood who did that amazing tweet to the Paris Review just saying, so is Paris any good or what?
And these are really... I mean, when you're reading about how other writers write, maybe you're always hoping that there'll be a little, you know, a trick or a routine or something that'll provide you with the same kind of magic.
Gosh, yeah. Someone's just going to say, if you just go out and eat some leaves at four in the morning, exactly. it'll come rather than you just have to sit down and do it.
I think there's one in the John Cheever one. There's something about him. His office was in the same building where he lived, and he would go downstairs. He would put on a suit and go downstairs and then change out of the suit into his writing clothes and then do the same thing in reverse so that there was a sense of going to work and rolling up his sleeves. And I think it's also in here, the... Joan Didion. I wonder if it's in here, because Joan Didion was a journalist and a very fast typer. Typist. A very fast typist. That she would start... The first day of writing a book, she'd write 1,000 words. And then the second day, she would write the first 1,000 words out again and continue and do the next 2,000 words. And then on the next day, write 3,000 words. And so she was editing as she went along and typing the whole thing out.
Like learning a piece on a musical instrument where you keep adding.
Yeah, exactly. Refining and doing that in chunks until the book was finished. But sort of just through the act of typing it out, refining it and making sure that every word is worth typing. I may have made that up completely, but I remember reading something like that and thinking, well, that's the key. The key is not to edit the document you have, but to start the document again. And when I wrote...
Have you been doing that?
When I wrote One Day, I did that. Yeah, I wrote it all and then I wrote it all again. I mean, I didn't do it day by day, but I didn't edit the document I had. I started it again and then I did it again. And it took forever. I mean, it did what you'd hope it would do. You know, it made you think about each word and give it wonder, is this paragraph really necessary? Because you're not editing what's already there and you're having to do the labour, and it does feel like labour. But it took far too long, and I'm not sure that the benefits were outweighed the hours I put in. But I did do that. And
you're saying that about One Day, then that must have been a real labour.
Well, it took a lot longer than anything else I'd written. Not just because I wasn't editing the document, but just planning and all. And there was no one particularly tapping their watch for me to deliver it, so I took as long as it needed. But I haven't done that since. I always think I should. I always think it's good to start with a blank page and... It's superstitious, isn't it? But feel every word going into the file and feel that it's worth its weight.
I think Jane Didion's interesting because she's had this odd sort of... I don't think she's ever not been, you know, beloved or read, but she seems to be having a bit of a sort of renaissance.
Yeah. I read Play It As It Lays, which really stayed with me. It has this, it's sort of like a Bret Easton Ellis novel before Bret Easton Ellis. It has a kind of a sort of chilly, sort of cokey, nasty, hollow feel to it. It's a very brilliant Hollywood novel. It's very disturbing. I thought that was fantastic, and I've read quite a lot of the
I know
journalism.
It's a daft thing to say, but I think it's really, really interesting how you talk about, you know, written, obviously you're extremely well read. I've seen many, many books.
Well,
the stories that you tell, do you have so much warmth to them? And I don't know whether you agree or not, but that you're a lot of your successes, I think, that you have written books where people feel as though they're among friends.
I'm happy that's the case. I always think that they're much darker than the response that they get. I mean, I always think that they're about people falling to pieces or having breakdowns or terrible, difficult family relationships or love affairs that aren't quite right. But I suppose they're all also about people trying to be better, you know, there's a recurring phrase in Sweet Sorrow about the character trying to find a way to move through the world, you know, a better way to be. And the characters are always earnestly pursuing that, trying to be better even as they do things which are either misguided or wrong. I sometimes think maybe I should write something really cruel or cold or dark. You know, there's this, there's not a respectability, but a kind of... people quite often say in defence of something, oh, it's very dark, you know, it's very dark and difficult. And I wonder if I could write something that was actively spiteful or cruel. Now I come to think of that, though, when after One Day came out, I did start writing a book and wrote quite a lot of it that was much more unpleasant than anything I'd written.
Was that much to do with the response of One Day and having
I
this?
Think it was that sense, that desire to show Jumping kind of versatility. That you can do something different and going off in a wildly different direction than very quickly I realised was a mistake, and I threw this thing away. But it was definitely an attempt to spoil people's enjoyment, I suppose. I mean, it's very perverse to write a book that was so much more difficult and nasty. I'm making it sound as if it was this, you know.
I wonder if that's an element of, you know, the acting legacy, is when you get known for a particular role, yeah. You keep being put up for that role, and you're like, well, no, I
want to do something else.
I can be Hamlet and Polonius, thank you. Yeah. I have the range.
And yet, I mean, I worry about that sometimes as a writer, that I'm aware there are enough of the books now for me to realise that there are certain things that I come back to and have done more than once. You know, there's always a party scene. There's often scenes of social embarrassment. There's often difficult relationships with parents. And I'm aware that there's a danger that they become cliches or tropes that you repeat yourself. And at the same time, you can make it's sometimes a terrible mistake to strain to show your versatility, to go off in a direction that isn't just unexpected, but something that you can't do. To miscast yourself. And I think about that a lot and worry about that, whether I should write something that's wildly different or whether that's just self-destructive and doomed to failure.
Thanks so much, David. Do follow him on Twitter and give him some love. He's at David N. Writer. Also, David has been such a generous and enthusiastic supporter of the podcast since we launched, so it's been a real delight to have him on. I'm Daisy Buchanan, and I've been your book inspector. Thank you so much for joining me, fellow bibliobabes. You can find me on Twitter at NotRoyalGirl and on Instagram at TheDaisyBee. Say hello, suggest some guests, and watch out for shelfies. Visit our show page, acast.com/booked, for more information about our guests and a list of the books they've talked about. If you have any other queries about the podcast, you can email us at ybooked@gmail.com. That's the letter Y, booked@gmail. Your Booked is produced by Dale Shaw for New Alaska and hosted by Acast. Please do subscribe, rate us, and leave a review. It's great to hear what you think, and it helps other people find the podcast. I leave you with the following. A man walks into the library and says, "Hello, I'd like a pizza." The librarian frowns. "Sir, this is a library." "Oh, sorry," says the man. "Hello, I'd like a pizza."
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.